Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. First, we continue our monthly segment on the importance and connection of art and culture in our mountain lifestyle and community. We're joined by Hadley Dynick, Executive Director of the Arts Council, and Corrine Humphrey, this month's Artist in Focus.
And then we'll explore the Inca formula for transformation with local Western shaman Danielle Bryan, who will be presenting a medicine wheel workshop throughout 2017 in four different classes.
And then we dive into the sometimes controversial topic of vaccines with author of The Vaccine Race, Meredith Wadman.
All interesting conversations coming up this hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these words. It's The Mountain Life.
Josh Carr here, Membership Director at Park Meadows Country Club, sponsor of KPCW. Park Meadows offers an 18-hole Jack Nicklaus golf course, weekly ski groups, on-mountain club including parking and locker room at Chateau Deer Valley, cross-country skiing, fine dining, and fitness center. Golf and social memberships available at 649-2460 or on the web.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Intermountain Park City Hospital, inviting you to come fall in love with our new North Building. We'll be having a Valentine-themed open house to show it all off. There will be tours, kid-friendly games, prizes, and even more lovely. The first 250 adults to attend will receive two free tickets to an upcoming Dr. Oz presentation in our new conference center. Cupid strikes at the hospital on February 9th from 4 to 6 p.m. Follow us on Facebook for more details. Park City Hospital is a not-for-profit community hospital and proudly supports KPCW.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, it's time for our monthly update on the status of art and culture in Summit County and Park City. This is a new monthly feature that we thought we'd include in the show to highlight the importance of art and culture in this community and in our lives in general, how it chalks up to lifestyle in general. Hadley Dynack, is the Executive Director of the Art Council, and Hadley has brought Corrine Humphrey. She is a local author of children's books and travel guides to share with us how the creative process and how Corrine's dog, Rudy, inform her life and work. Hadley and Corrine, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having us.
Wonderful to have you. Well, let's talk about Rudy, first of all. and just the inspiration, Corrine, that you, I mean, we all look for inspiration in our lives. And it's interesting how, in many cases, our animals, those animals we love, our children, our animals, you know, what was it about Rudy, who's very sadly no longer with us as of a couple of months ago? Sorry for your loss. But Rudy was this wonderful dog that it inspired you how?
You know, it's so funny because inspiration comes from really unexpected sources sometimes. And I have a friend who, I've got six children's books now, and Rudy's the star of all of them. And I have a friend, and she said, I've known you for 35 years. And she said, you're not an artist. You're not a writer. Where the heck did all this come from? And I said, well, I adopted this dog. And I took 5 years off from flying. I'm a flight attendant. So I took 5 years off from flying because I was sick of it. And I needed some more creativity and meaning in my life. So I thought, well, I'm never going back. I can get a dog. So I went to Friends of Animals over and over again. And I had been volunteering there. And I found Rudy. And then at the same time, I also thought, oh, now I can take these painting classes that I've always wanted to take. So I took just an adult education painting class. And then I got really inspired by a Canadian artist who had a show in town called Beaks and Muzzles, and all she painted were birds and dogs. So I went back to my little painting class and changed my landscape to a painting with Rudy, and it sold that year at the Kimmel Art Festival Gala, and the woman that bought the painting bought another one, so she had one for each granddaughter. And it just, you know, it was just started rolling from there, and it was just these big, bold paintings of Rudy, and paired with positive messages for kids. So it just kind of took on a life of its own. So,
right.
Yeah.
You know, I think we all look for inspiration in our lives, and we go through these periods of our lives where we don't feel inspired, we don't feel creative. And it may not be that it's a low point in our lives, it's just that we're doing something else that activates another portion of our brain, or, you know, the things, the daily activities are more rote, less creative. And I mean, did you feel in your life as a flight attendant like that's what was happening? And did you know that you were looking for inspiration?
Yes. And I have since gone back to flying, and it's been a great job. And as far as, you know, because it affords me a lot of flexibility and a lot of time off to pursue other things. Yeah. So I'm really lucky in that respect. But it's not a creative outlet. Yeah. And so it's just nice to be able to do that on the side and just kind of get back in touch with whatever creativity means to you, whether it's gardening or writing or art or sculpture. So,
Corinne, having been a flight attendant and not considering yourself creative, and then finding this door that opens for you and you stepped fully into it, embraced it, did it create a different sense of what's available to everyone?
Yes.
In creative ways? Because
yes.
Was it surprising to you that
people
you were like, hey, I'm painting, I'm writing children's
books? Well,
people
say all the time, oh, I'm not creative. I'm like, yes, you are. You just need to find your avenue. And it has helped me with kids, because I worked and taught for Arts Kids for years, and then I was on the Arts Kids boards. And it was like that with when I was meeting with the kids. And one of the paintings in one of my books is, it doesn't matter what kind of dog you are, you can create the life you want. So I would use that as a tool for these kids to start generating ideas in their head and giving them the freedom to, and giving myself the freedom to create and make an ugly painting if it turns out ugly, or just try new things. And it just really helped me just loosen up a little bit and not be so, you know, rigid.
Well, in a way, and Hadley, maybe this is better for you to answer, but either one of you, you know, there's a little bit of a problem from the standpoint of how we describe creativity and how we define it within our society, right? I mean, it's painting, it's writing, but you just rattled off a bunch of others. You know, we can find it in a lot of different ways, gardening and whatnot. And I know from my experience, my current experience being on city council, I've heard from other council members, and myself included, I don't consider myself to be creative. And there's another council member who says, I'm the least creative person that anyone would ever know. But at the same time, there's a component, it's much different. It's kind of institutionalized creativity that goes into policy decisions. That's a creative, that takes visioning and looking into the future and trying to create something, you know, by the decisions we make today that will lead to something in the future. There's a creative component to that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when we think of arts and culture and we think of creativity, we think of going and doing something or experiencing something. So you go to a film or you go to some music or a performance. But what we're really talking about with this segment is the art of inspiration and how inspiration can inspire us all to do creative things, whether it's make policy, make a painting, or write a book. And we decided on this topic for this particular segment because it happens to be National Children's Author and Children's Book Author and Illustrator Week. And, you know, the literary arts are actually surprisingly robust in Park City and Summit County. You know, we've got the Artists in the Schools program where authors come into the school and talk to our young people. We've got book signings and at Dolly's Bookstore. We've got the One Book, One Community, which is pretty incredible for a small town where the Ed Foundation and both the Summit County and the Park City Libraries come together and promote our community to come together and talk about a particular book that might relate to who we are culturally and how we connect to the world. And then amazing authors like Corinne and a host of other children's book authors as well. So anyways, it's a robust part of who we are and how arts and culture connects to our mountain lifestyle.
Yeah. So Corinne, why children's books? I mean, I can see the tie-in with the art, but how did it manifest there? Instead of something else, like just selling your art, for example?
That's a good question. My paintings are, the illustrations for the book are big acrylic on canvas, because I like to paint big and it's just more fun. I went to this Writing and Illustrating for Young Readers conference, and I had this pile of paintings. I didn't really know what to do with them. I knew I wanted to do a book. But I've been in the writing community. I've been on the board of Writers at Work. I've been at novel writing workshops and things like that. So I'm familiar with, and I've done a lot of freelance writing, so it felt like a natural progression to do a book. And to me, a book is lasting. I mean, the painting might be sold and then you never see it again, whereas the book seems to be, you can share it more.
Yeah.
Because it can go out to thousands of people instead of just one painting. And, does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I would imagine there are people listening right now that say, you know, I'm at one of those, in one of those dry spells. You know, how do I recognize inspiration in my life? You know, I've felt a lot of inspiration in my life before when I've fallen in love, you know, like the colors are more brilliant and you find this inspiration, which sounds kind of lame to me that that's like what I identify with.
But there's been studies on brain studies that talk about inspiration and talk about falling in love and the chemical reactions in your brain and what causes that. I'm kind of in a just coming out of a really dry spell myself, you know, after this winter, and I had just had to kind of recenter myself. I took a life drawing class the other day. You know, I've met with Hadley to try and come up with some new things, and I met with another artist friend last night. So it's just kind of, I've started meditating again in the morning and listening to nice classical music or doing some sketches in the morning and kind of getting back into that routine. And going to museums, you know, I just had a long Amsterdam layover, so I spent hours at the Van Gogh Museum and just kind of filling the well again, you know, either being out in nature, you know, walking on the beach or walking on the trails and turning off your phone and turning off, you know, TV and the news and kind of getting back centered.
And Hadley, what's going on these days with respect to the Art Council? I know you're in kind of the early stages of formulating a master plan, and why don't you tell us kind of just give us a status update.
All right. Well, Arts Council's busy as usual. Maybe before I answer the question on master planning, I'll just kind of add something to this other thought around inspiration.
Please do.
Because one of the things that the Arts Council does is programming our own and in partnership with others. And the 27th, which I guess maybe was last Friday, I don't know, the dates are escaping me. We did a partnership with an organization in Salt Lake called Creative Mornings, which is actually a worldwide network of creatives that come together once a month to share ideas and connect with one another. And there's a speaker, and we hosted it up here. We're going to host another one at some point this spring and summer, but we hosted it. And Mary Beth Maziers was the speaker. And she did a talk that every month there's a theme to organize these meetups that are happening all around the world. And this last month's theme was mystery. And her talk was on the mystery of the creative process and where we find our inspiration. And the title of her talk was Mood and Muse. And she challenged the people that were there. And we had about 55 people. It was a really great turnout of people from both the front and the back of the Wasatch, thinking about, you know, when you're writing policy or when you're doing a painting, where are you getting your ideas? What kind of music are you listening to? Where are you physically? Are you outside? Are you inside? Are you in a loud environment where you can tune it out, or are you in a quiet environment? And just thinking about noticing those things, so that when you do need to fill up your well or go and create some body of work in some format, that you understand where you can find your inspiration. So I thought that was connected to what we're talking about, and she did a really beautiful job, and of course brought in music, which is always lovely.
And do you have set dates for when you're going to have these?
Well, the Creative Mornings chapter in Salt Lake meets the last Friday of the month, and it's CMSLC is the hashtag CMSLC, and you can join their newsletter, and they'll send out a notice to you when it's going to be. we decided rather than forming our own group that we would partner with them, again, to try to build connections and partnerships. And so we'll host two or three up here a year and hopefully bring some of their crew here. And then hopefully some of our creatives will go down there and connect with them.
And how do people join your newsletter? You just mentioned that. So give us kind of the details on the Art Council website and joining the newsletter to be informed.
Yes, great question, and thank you for that. So the Arts Council has a very strong Facebook presence. It's the Park City Summit County Arts Council, and that's a great way to track what is going on in the community and what we are doing. We also have Instagram and Twitter feeds, which are at PCSC Arts. So please follow all of those things. And then the newsletter, which we actually have two now, one that goes out monthly that talks about all of the events that are going on in our community, and another that we just launched called Create that is specific for creatives to talk about classes and opportunities to connect with one another, as well as open calls for art. So you can learn about those on the website, which is pcscarts.org. We're actually getting ready to launch a new website. I guess I'm telling it publicly now in the next couple
You're
weeks.
About to.
So there'll be a lot more information there. And then, so we've got these programs that we've talked about. We've got the marketing and promotion, which we've just talked about. And then the third bucket of our work is in the policy and advocacy realm. And so that's where this master planning project falls in. And we're really excited to really launch this publicly. We're raising money for the launch right now, and you know, we're really hoping that it will be a huge community-wide opportunity for people to get involved in shaping the future of arts and culture in our community.
Such wonderful work. Yeah. Before we let you go, Corrine, can you just rattle off all of the book titles with Rudy?
The first one was called The Tao of Rudy. And the second, I did a bilingual version of that one with Spanish and English on the same page. Then Chronicle Books picked it up, and they came out with the sequel called Shoot for the Moon, Lessons on Life from a Dog Named Rudy. And then they also have an ebook version of that. And then I came out with the sequel, the third one in the series, called Wake Up to Love, Lessons on Friendship from a Dog Named Rudy. And then I started a new travel guide series for older kids called Roaming with Rudy. So I have Roaming with Rudy Paris and Roaming with Rudy Washington, D.C., and I'm now working on London and San Diego. And we just won a Silver Moonbeam Children's Book Award for best series in that one. And that one's also available as an animated audio ebook. I've been working with a company in India to put that together, and it's so much fun. It's been a steep, steep learning curve for me, but it's been really fun to work on that, so...
Wonderful. So that's kind of your now project, your current project?
And I have another art show coming up at the Salt Lake City Library. It'll run all through this next summer in the Children's Gallery. So.
You are just going places.
Yeah, that dry spell's over.
Yeah, I think it was a very short-lived dry spell.
Yeah, hopefully it's over.
All right. Well, Corrine Humphrey and Hadley Dynack, thanks so much for joining us on this second monthly installation of arts and culture in our community on The Mountain Life.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
Thanks, Lynn.
And thanks, Tim.
And we'll be right back after these words. We're going to talk with Danielle Bryan about shamanism when we return.
Hi, this is Chris Eggleton.
And Chris Retzer of Destination Hotels Utah, proud sponsor of KPCW.
Since 2005, we've provided nightly rental, retail, and community management services
to New Park Town Center, Prospector Square, Empire Pass, and Touhe.
More information about Destination Hotels Utah is at dhutah.com.
This is Danny Warner, owner of Chateau Recovery, and proud to sponsor The Mountain Life on KPCW. Chateau Recovery provides comprehensive and holistic care to create direction and focus for adults looking for an empowering and effective recovery experience. Information available at 866-808-4160 or chateaurecovery.com. Addiction is a disease. Recovery is a choice.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with Tim Henney. Such a nice conversation with Hadley Dynack, the executive director of the Summit County Park City Arts Council, and also Corrine Humphrey, the author of all those wonderful books about Rudy. Now, our guest, Danielle Bryan. is a Four Winds trained Western shaman who works in and with energetic fields to help people deal with the past and the future while connecting to a more clear and powerful present experience. She'll be leading a workshop, Medicine Wheel Journey, A Year of Transformation, in four classes throughout this year, 2017. Danielle, we're pleased that you could be joining us. Welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks. Thanks, Lynn and Tim.
So I know there are a lot of people, well, all of us have heard about shamanism. Not all of us knows what it is. So give us a definition.
There are several definitions for shamanism depending on where in the world you are. So it's actually out of Siberia. Shamanism is where it has stemmed from. And I would say the definition of shamanism is the ability to see in between the worlds or in between the spaces. So what happens when we turn toward the shamanic practices is we are able to track what we call tracking energy, or seeing the spaces that are not visible in our typical reality. In our physical reality, yeah.
The way that I've been able to get my head around it a little bit is we have a physical body, we have a spiritual body, we have an intellectual body, and then there's this other body that we never really acknowledge, which is the energetic body. And once you start thinking in those terms, you can see how that energetic body informs and influences all those other bodies. Certainly our health body, right? Our physical health body is significantly
Absolutely.
Informed by the energetic.
Absolutely. The energy body is something that we all are very aware of. It's very palpable, but it's invisible. Right. So, and it also has these senses. So when we walk into a room and we know that something has been going on because we feel it, right? We talk about this, like, I can feel something's been happening in here. That's our energy body that is picking up on the energy of the space of the room. So it's that invisible place. And the shamans traditionally have been able to see energy bodies. They can see into the spirit world. They can see all those places that we don't see with our physical eyes.
Mm. So when you enter into a study of shamanism, you're most likely a person who has felt great energetic presence. You know, you talk about going into a room and you feel the energy of the room. So, you know, a lot of times we describe this as intuition or gut feeling,
right.
Or, you know, we talk about the juju or what are some of the other words like that, you know?
The heavy hoochah is another one.
That's good. So no doubt you were one of those people who felt that very heavily and you wanted to be able to also see it in a physical way. And I mean,
right.
Or is that correct? And
is that
what you did at Four Winds, which, by the way, maybe you should also explain that. It's in Park City.
Right. It was in Park City, actually. Oh. The Four Winds main headquarters was in Park City for over 10 years. And now they're based out of Miami, actually.
Oh,
so
okay.
So it is the Four Winds is a practitioner training school that I did train with. And then I had the great pleasure of working with them for several years. And so I got to continue my study in real life, everyday working world. But to answer your question, Lynn, everybody sees in a different way. So when we talk about tracking and seeing the invisible, you're not always, some people really do see the energy, like people who can read auras, for instance, right? They can see what's happening in your field, and they can see the colors, and they can see the striations of the different auric levels and those kinds of things.
I would love to see that.
I know.
I've always wanted to see the Northern Lights also, but
right.
Boy, would I like to see auras.
And so, yes, I personally did have experiences in my young life that were obvious that I was more sensitive, or I could see, or that something was different. But that's not always the case. So yes, it led me into studying the shamanic practices, because I was trained as a massage therapist, and what would happen is I'd be working with clients, and then I would begin to sense that there was something different happening, and I could get the information. For me, it would come through as information, like thoughts, mm-hmm. and I didn't know what to do with that. It's not helpful to say to somebody, well, you've got a whole bunch of things happening in your second chakra that are very emotional. Good luck with that. I hope you can work it out. So it began my quest to learn, what do I do with this information? What do I do with the fact that information comes to me like this? How can I turn this into a resource and actually allow this gift, if you will, to be helpful? But it's not just a gift. Anybody can step into these realms and begin to hone the skill sets that we all have. We all have the skill set of intuition.
So this is great. This is what your four courses are throughout this mm-hmm. calendar year. It's called A Year of Transformation. It's a medicine wheel journey. Mm-hmm. So talk about the when, where, and how, and all that.
The logistics. So the medicine wheel journey is a map of going through these four directions. And this is very much rooted in Incan shamanism. So there are a lot of medicine wheels out in the world. There's the North American, Native American medicine wheel. There's the South American medicine wheel. So this is my lineage that I walk is rooted in the Incan shamanism of South America. So we will be moving through the medicine wheel in the directions of the south, the west, the north, and the east. Those are the four primary classes. And the first one, the south direction, will be held March 30th to April 2nd in Camas, Utah. And then the west is in the second weekend of June. The north is the third weekend of September, and the east is the first weekend of December.
And Danielle, who's this going to appeal to? I mean, if somebody's listening right now, mm-hmm. what's your hope for somebody who says, oh, wow, that's, you know, really interesting, or this is something I know about, I want to mm-hmm. delve deeper, mm-hmm. this is something that I'm really practicing already, mm-hmm. I want to take that practice and expand it. Who's the target audience?
The target audience is really anybody who feels the call. Sometimes, like for me, I was called into it without really even knowing what I was getting into. It was just a, yes, I'm intrigued by this and I want to move in this direction. So there's a lot of times a response to hearing something that we don't even fully understand why we're being drawn to it. So it appeals to anybody, but it also appeals to the person who's ready to begin to look at their life from a different perspective and from a place of the journey. What a big part of this work will do is help us to move into a lens of engaging our life from a journey perspective. We will begin to recognize and get off of the triangle, the disempowerment triangle, which houses the players of victim, rescuer, and perpetrator. And I would say that most of us default into viewing our life from one of those positions. So moving through the wheel, we can take anything that we have happening in our life and we can move it through this wheel where we begin to recognize where we're identified, where we need to differentiate from what is happening in our life, where we can integrate the lessons that we're learning, and we can transcend into a different place of engaging our journey.
So somebody who's out there and has been drawn to what they just heard, how did they sign up for this?
You can contact me directly via old school methods of emailing me at daniellebryan77@gmail.com, or you can contact me by phone, 435-640-8939. And I am on Facebook, Danielle Bryan. And they can reach out and find me in those methods.
All right, Danielle Bryan, a Four Winds trained Western shaman, and her course throughout the year, Medicine Wheel Journey, A Year of Transformation. Thanks so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, Tim.
And we'll be right back after this.
Grab the family and head out to Soldier Hollow in Midway to enjoy some winter tubing and cross-country skiing. We invite you to explore the 1,200-foot tubing lanes and the 34 kilometers of cross-country ski trails featuring immaculate grooming and buried terrain for beginners to expert skiers. Soldier Hollow is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, vaccines, to some, are controversial, to others, not at all. Vaccines are made originally from fetal cells. Some believe they're linked to autism, and others have saved millions of lives since the first rubella vaccine was developed back in 1962. As scientists scramble to develop now a Zika vaccine, Meredith Wadman, the author of the new book, The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease, tells us why vaccines matter and also about the price that was paid 50 years ago for the protection that they still deliver today. Meredith Wadman, welcome to The Mountain Life.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Meredith, your book is fascinating, especially the history. I didn't know initially until reading through your book about fetal cells, and take us back to 1962, was it 1964? And the development of the rubella vaccine.
Sure. Well, there were basically no guards or defenses against rubella at the time. And rubella is a virus that, like Zika, attacks fetuses in the wombs of pregnant women and devastates them. In fact, it makes Zika look mild by comparison. It damages virtually every fetal organ. And there was a massive epidemic in this country in 1964 and 65. More than 12 million Americans were infected. And as a result, tens of thousands of babies were born blind, deaf, intellectually disabled, with holes in their hearts, with combinations of these conditions. And that was because there was no vaccine. And not only that, rubella, when you or I get it, is a mild disease. We might not even show we have it. So pregnant women couldn't even stay away from infected people because half the time you didn't know if someone was infected. It was a terrible dilemma and a really scary time to be pregnant in this country.
Mm. Absolutely. Go ahead.
It's kind of amazing how the things that we take for granted today, and maybe it's just me, maybe moms are much more attuned. But I remember when my kids, who are now 28 and 26, you went in for the rubella and the rhino and the whole series of vaccinations, which even at that time, 28 years ago, I was like, great, we're getting our children's vaccinations, but what does it mean? And I had no idea that rubella was such a big deal back in the early to mid-60s. And I'm sure there are other diseases that have been dealt with through vaccines that we take for granted today and don't really have a connection to the past and the impacts that they had during that generation.
Oh, there absolutely are. And I think some of the complacency around vaccination is because essentially we don't see these diseases anymore. Vaccines are, in a way, a victim of their own success. There were like 500,000 cases of measles every year prior to the vaccine. Last year there were 69. Diphtheria, which is a terrible disease that can suffocate a child by basically wrapping a membrane over his or her windpipe. There were 21,000 cases a year before the vaccine. Now there's zero. Polio is gone. We don't see kids in wheelchairs or in leg braces. And so young parents in this era, look around and say, well, what's the big deal? It is a big deal. And the reason we don't see these diseases is because people continue to vaccinate. And that's absolutely essential to our continuing not to see these diseases.
After all of the research that you've done, which has been really exhaustive, but I'm wondering if you believe that we should pick and choose about our vaccines? You know, so many people, even people like naturopathic doctors will say, that picking and choosing and looking at the vaccines is prudent. Do you believe that, or do you think that we should sign up for the whole spattering and the number that we're told to get? Do you think we should question vaccines? Because so many do.
You know, I just I want to first say that it's a very vocal minority that mm-hmm. questions vaccines. And I would just point to a Pew Research Center study that came out last week that showed 88% of adult Americans strongly supportive of vaccines and saying that their benefits outweigh their costs. And I should add that they were addressing in particular the MMR vaccine, but I think it's fair to say that that's a pretty good proxy for childhood vaccination in general. But I would like to just backtrack and get to the issue of whether, you know, there's too many vaccines. There is a committee of experts at the Centers for Disease Control. These are vaccine experts and public health experts and disease trackers in the community. These are people who make it their business, whose lives are devoted to ensuring that vaccines are safe and effective. They recommend a schedule of childhood vaccines based on the best science there is. Our kids' interests are their interests. They do what they do because they care about our children. Therefore, I would really urge any parent who is doubtful of the childhood vaccine schedule to have a serious talk with your pediatrician. And I'm hoping very much that you will keep an open mind and remember that it's not like these recommendations come out of thin air. They come out of the best science that we have. The final thing I'd like to note is that a 2002 paper in the journal Pediatrics did an estimate and determined that giving an infant 11 vaccines in one sitting, which never happens, but were you to do that, that would use up about 0.1% of that child's immune system's ability to respond to vaccination. So you're on safe ground. That's all I can say. Vaccines save lives.
Okay. Let's go back to the history a bit. With the fetal cells and how the first vaccines were developed, and do we use fetal cells anymore? There's so much controversy around that to develop vaccines.
Yes, absolutely. So I'd like to just begin by pointing out these weren't the first vaccines, but these were early vaccines being developed at a time when basically the only childhood vaccine available was polio and smallpox, although smallpox was in the process of going away as a disease. But in the early 1960s, most viral diseases did not have a vaccine. And so Leonard Hayflick, a young scientist at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia, used the lungs from one legally aborted fetus. The abortion had been carried out in Sweden, where abortion was legal at the time, unlike in all 50 U.S. states, used those lungs to develop a self-replicating group of cells that basically became a clean, safe set of like mini factories that the cells churn out the vaccine. The vaccine is grown in them, essentially, because what the vaccine is simply a weakened virus, and viruses need cells to replicate in. Prior to that, the polio vaccine had been developed in monkey kidney cells. These cells contained all kinds of silent monkey viruses, and it wasn't known if these viruses could be damaging to people. So Hayflick, who developed the human fetal cells from this one aborted fetus, decided that this would be a cleaner and safer approach. And lo and behold, he was born out. Today we've got vaccines made in these cells or in one other group of human fetal cells from one abortion conducted in England in 1966 to produce vaccines against rubella, against rabies, against hepatitis A, against chickenpox, against shingles, and against adenovirus, which is used by the U.S. military. More than 10 million new military recruits since 1970 have been protected against this respiratory disease that is common when you're living in a crowded condition like a boot camp. So these vaccines have done just enormous public health good.
And Meredith, I guess this is a continuing process. There are people who are developing vaccines today. I mean, Zika is, you know, the one that's in the headlines, but there are, every time we have a flu season, you know, it's the bird flu or, you know, some combination of letters and numbers flu, and then West Nile. So are those, is that just a never-ending process of people looking at the latest viruses and attempting to develop vaccines to address them?
It absolutely is, because viruses never rest. They're constantly evolving to find new species and hosts that they can invade. They don't stay the same across time. So we're constantly kept on our toes. And yes, it may be Zika today, but there may be something else tomorrow. And so technologies and science are constantly being applied to develop vaccines, or to be ready to develop a vaccine against, you know, Ebola, for instance, which, you know, that just came out of the blue in 2014. So we have to stay on our toes.
And I'm curious about the potential tipping point with people who, you know, as you just made a plea, stay open-minded, talk to your pediatrician, you know, have that informed conversation and be open to the possibility, even if you're maybe predisposed to be against the possibility of vaccinating. And I know there are a lot of people who will not get their children vaccinated. And when I say a lot, maybe it's a tiny, minuscule number. But when does that become a concern in the bigger picture of the vaccination and virus world? When does that little population that hasn't been vaccinated start to impact, or how long are they protected by the rest of us?
Right. So I think a fair number is to say you want to have at least above 90% vaccination rates, and 93 or 95 is much better. And it depends on the virus. Like measles is just the most contagious virus. And so you've got to keep those vaccination rates up. Once you fall below a certain level of vaccinated children or individuals, the virus can get a foothold in that community in unvaccinated people. And so you saw the outbreak at Disneyland in 2015 of measles, because California and certain communities is a bit of an epicenter of vaccine resistance. You're going to continue to see these outbreaks if and when that threshold number of vaccinees, you know, starts to edge down below 90%. And that's a really serious concern. And I think parents need to be cognizant that not only are they protecting their own child when they get them vaccinated, they're protecting the children around them. So it's both important for us as individuals and as communities.
We're speaking with Meredith Wadman. She has covered biomedical research politics from Washington for 20 years. She's a reporter at Science. She has also written for Nature, Fortune, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal. Her new book is called The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease. And Meredith, I want to ask you about some of the, well, part of the evolution of vaccines. When one is formed, I think there are various preservatives and things like that that need to keep getting better, the evolution of preservatives, and also I'm wondering about the different strains of vaccines, whether a live virus is administered or a killed virus, I guess you would call it, is administered. What's going on there in scientific advancement?
Well, it really varies with the vaccine, and I suppose a really good example to use is the killed polio vaccine.
Right.
It was used initially in the 1950s because it was the first vaccine developed, and the virus was killed with formaldehyde, and so what you have is a dead virus that's provoking your system to produce antibodies, but that, you know, can in no way infect you. Then along in 1961 comes what was called the Sabin polio vaccine. It was a live, weakened virus, weakened enough so that it wouldn't cause infection, but still living in a weakened form. That was used because it was more effective at generating antibodies, and it was easier to administer. Children swallowed it rather than needing to be vaccinated. So it, you know, with injections, so it didn't require skilled health personnel, and that became the vaccine that was used for four decades. Basically, you know, throughout the rest of the 20th century. Then, around the turn of the century, it was determined by CDC and others that the balance had tipped and that it was better to go back to using the Kills vaccine, because extremely occasionally, one in a million sort of thing, the live vaccine could cause symptoms or even paralysis in someone who received it. Now, back in the day when 16,000 children a year were being paralyzed by polio, a one in a million chance was a chance well worth taking, because the outcome was so terrible, you know, if a child was infected by polio. Now that there's zero cases of polio in our country, we're using a killed vaccine instead. So times change, exposures change, and regulators that are responsible for watching these things change with them. I hope that's a good example and it somewhat answers your question.
Yeah. And then at what point, for example, I'm not sure when it happened, I'm sure you know, but we no longer took a smallpox vaccine. I think it was when I was a child, you no longer had to get smallpox because the very final case of smallpox in the entire world was eradicated. I guess that's at the point that you are able to discontinue the use of a vaccine.
Absolutely. And that was, I believe it was discontinued in 1970 in this country or thereabouts. Exactly. And we're very close to eradicating polio, although it stubbornly persists in just two or three countries now. When we get there, that'll be a real moment to celebrate.
And Meredith, you mentioned the CDC, and I have to say, I watched this movie last night, which is quite coincidental, Contagion. And I don't even know when Contagion was put out. But, you know, they talked about a whole bunch of this stuff. And that's about a pandemic and how it spreads and a virus and, you know, the battle to come up with a vaccine to deal with it, which they finally do. But they talk about a lot of these things, live viruses, dead viruses. But they also talk about back in 1918 with, I think it was the Spanish flu that killed something like 70 million people worldwide. And we don't even consider that possibility anymore as a real possibility. And yet I'll bet the CDC certainly sees that as not an if, but a when. And is that part of this discussion as well?
Yeah, now flu is really tricky because it's constantly evolving. There needs to be a new vaccine every year, but occasionally through sort of morphing between pigs and humans, often, or birds and humans, you can get a really dangerous strain. And hopefully it's a, you know, once in a 500-year event. But as you point out rightly, it was a horrifying and worldwide event in 1918. And I think, it's a bit like the next earthquake. You sort of hold your breath and prepare as best you can, but there's no telling when it arises.
And so is that what these scientists who are, you know, working on every vaccine they're trying to contain is the next potential pandemic? Is that sort of the big picture overarching mission?
I think so, but it's also to respond to diseases that are really terrible in other countries, largely developing countries, that we don't see, where there's a real need and where there's not oftentimes an incentive for pharmaceutical companies to go there because the payoff isn't there. So recently there was established, with the help of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in some other countries, including Norway, a fund that's going to fund development of several vaccines that are mainly occurring in third world countries. And I think that's all to the good.
And, like that movie that I watched last night, Contagion, which I was drawn into it probably because we were going to be talking to you today in one way. But also, you know, the moment I started watching it, it hooked me. It's quite a compelling story. And here it is about science and vaccines and a virus and a pandemic and not necessarily the type of thing that I would think I would just choose. And that might apply to your book also. I mean, you're dealing with a lot of science and technical aspects, but you've been able to convey it in a way that is really captivating for a broad audience. I'm assuming that was your intention.
Oh, it absolutely was. I wanted people to enter with me into 1964 and to be at the Philadelphia orphanage run by the Catholic Church, where a rubella vaccine was first tested on 1 and 2 year olds without, you know, so much as a buy or leave, except from the Archbishop. To be with me in a state hospital in Pennsylvania for intellectually disabled children who, again, were tested on without their knowledge or consent. It was a different era, in medical research, and these populations were used, which was a really, you know, in retrospect, it's just a horrifying and hard-to-accept event. Fortunately, our human subjects' protections laws and policies have come a long way, and those kinds of trials these days would never be allowed. But it's important to remember the children, largely, on whom these vaccines were tested, and to honor their contribution by using the vaccines.
Mm. Tell me where we are before we let you go here in a few minutes on the Zika vaccine. I believe I read in Discover magazine that we're already testing something on small groups of animals, perhaps. Where are we now?
Well, there's several vaccine candidates, fortunately, and we kind of had a platform for getting up and running quickly with the Zika vaccine because it's a cousin of dengue virus, and therefore, which was already in vaccine development, so they could kind of borrow the technology and use that technology to work on Zika. So there's all kinds of labs, governments behind getting a Zika vaccine as quickly as possible. That being said, the World Health Organization announced last month, I believe it was, that it's going to be at least 2020 before a vaccine is approved for use in women of childbearing age. So that's quite sobering. Mm.
The book is... go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to add that it's really important that funding for this kind of work be insulated from politics, because more than $1 billion in Zika funding for vaccine work got held up on Capitol Hill last summer.
Mm. Yeah, very interesting. The Vaccine Race, Science, Politics, and the Human Costs of Defeating Disease. It's just packed full of information, the history of vaccines in our country, in the world, and where we stand today. Meredith Wadman, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
It's been such a pleasure. Thanks, Lynn and Tim.
Thanks. Wow. And we'll be right back after this.
The Utah Legislature meets for 6 weeks from the end of January till mid-March, and KPCW News will cover all major developments affecting the Wasatch Back and you. Reports from Capitol Hill and your lawmakers are brought to you by Tesh Law, real estate, trusts and estates, and general litigation since 1989. TeshLaw.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And we'd like to thank the underwriters of The Mountain Life: Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Park Meadows Country Club, Park City Mountain, Chateau Recovery, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, and Destination Hotels Utah.
Excellent. Thank you. Excuse me.
Well, you're welcome.
And thanks to our underwriters. And, you know, we spoke in the first part of the hour about creativity, and I couldn't stop from thinking about John Henry, our friend who we lost over the weekend in a tragic accident. He was a frequent contributor to Tales from the Wasatch Back. I was, excuse me, and we'll miss him so much. But I just wanted to mention tomorrow, it's a celebration of John's life at 3 p.m. at Creekside Christian Fellowship, 1400 Bittner Road, and John's family is asking to bring something sweet to share. He loved chocolate. There's going to be a lot of sweets there. And please wear bright colors, so as he brought sweetness and color to all of our lives.
Yeah. A tragic loss and a nice way to remember John Henry.
Yes, absolutely. Had a really nice Toastmasters meeting yesterday, and everyone memorializing him and sharing stories that were wonderful, a really nice sort of therapy in the club that he co-founded many, many years ago.
Yeah, glad to hear that.
You're listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now for news.